977. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Executive Committee meets on the second Thursday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Camp KBOO is in session. Sign up to support us during our summer membership drive now through June 29th. All you have to do is check out kboo.fm/give, text KBOO to 44321, or mail us at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue and support a summer of memories together.
Pacifica Radio in San Francisco. This is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, Flashpoints contributor Sam Husseini reports from the United Nations, where the U.S. vetoed the current ceasefire proposal for Gaza. Also, the hunger strikers on the 14th day of their strike for peace in Gaza, and U.S. covert action expands again to deal with growing fight back people's movements in Haiti. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We now go to New York City and the United Nations, where we're joined by our special contributor, Sam Husseini. Sam, it was not a good day for peace in this world and in the Middle East. You want to sort of break it down, what happened today? The United States, of course, undermined any attempt at today's treaty. Or at least the pause in the genocide. Sam? Uh, Okay, we just lost Sam Hussein. I want to tell you that coming up later on in this broadcast, we'll be talking to some of the fasters, many on their 14th day of a 30-day fast, calling for the end of the genocide in Gaza. I hear some beeping in the background. I'm not sure if we have our guest yet, but also I should tell you that we have a very powerful segment coming up later on in the broadcast with our senior producer Kevin Pina, who, as you know, has been one of the preeminent reporters telling the story of the genocide in Haiti, yes, caused by the United States government destabilization policies, the U.S. wanting to control the resource riches of Haiti. We always hear about it as a poor country. It is not a poor country. It's just been screwed up. Okay, I think we're now going to go to New York City and the United Nations, where we are joined by Sam Husseini. Sam, welcome back to Flashpoints. Not a good day for peace in the world or the Middle East. The United States put the kibosh on another attempt at least a ceasefire. You want to sort of give us your sense of the situation, what happened, and the politics behind it?
Sure. It was a very mild resolution that the 10 elected members of the Security Council put forward. It called for a ceasefire. It called for aid to be allowed into Gaza. And it actually blessed the U.S., you know, so-called negotiating process for the entire situation. The U.S. was the sole veto. Everybody else voted for it, even, you know, Britain and France. So it, in the tenor of the U.S. representative's remarks were, you know, extremely over the top, you know, talking about how great this phony Gaza Humanitarian Foundation that they've set up is, how we can't go back to what it was before, which was basically UNRWA, which was basically the only major lifeline for the Palestinian people. And they kind of threatened the UN at the end that we shouldn't be engaging in such performative actions.
This is the United States warning the this is the United States warning the United Nations through the ambassador?
Correct. Basically saying the UN funding is under question, and such actions, when you know that there's going to be a veto for this, don't help the situation. I can't say I was heartened by many of the other statements, however, I should say. You know, that they, you know, generally call for a two-state solution and bless this upcoming Saudi-French proposal in that regard. You know, no one genuinely challenging the United States in their remarks. Again, the resolution itself blessed the U.S. process as if it was a meaningful peacemaking process, when the U.S. is sitting there in front of everybody being extremely belligerent. What should happen here, Dennis, is I think we've talked about it before, uniting for peace, which is when the General Assembly can step in when the Security Council has obviously failed in its responsibility to uphold international peace and security, and take matters into its own hands. And it's a massive organizing effort to get 2/3 of the countries of the General Assembly to do that. But that's really the only way out if the United Nations wants to preserve itself as having any, you know, meaningful role here, or if it's just going to end up, you know, just being a rug for the United States to trample upon as it pleases.
Your whole vision, all your work has been about trying to call attention to the situation, bring information, and bring some kind of peace, some kind of ceasefire. You're at the United Nations now, this has not been a good day. You want to talk a little bit about, just based on your covering this and trying to call attention to it, what the situation is on the ground now? My understanding is 400 more people have been killed since Monday, that the so-called food program, distribution program in Gaza was shut down today. It seems like the food givers, or at least the people who are bringing the food, are also assassins. So you want to talk about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, the U.S. and Israel, and this is a joint Israeli-U.S. operation at this point, have turned everything on its head. They've turned aid into a mechanism to trap as many Palestinians as possible by starving them everywhere else and saying that they're going to provide aid in one specific location and then shooting them when the aid is there, and seeming to eventually want to trap them in an ever smaller area so that they can then ethnically cleanse them. This is after they have sabotaged UNRWA and blocked out all other meaningful forms of aid. Freedom flotillas trying to get into Gaza have been sabotaged. It's been one thing after another. It's a very systematic effort to starve the Palestinian people, with the obvious goal of ethnically cleansing as many of them out of Gaza so that Israel can take it for its own. This has been a very systematic effort at the UN as well. This is the fifth time that the U.S. has vetoed a ceasefire resolution. Even when they haven't vetoed them, they have sabotaged international law. So, for example, the ICJ in the South Africa genocide case issued orders a year ago in late May of 2024, saying that Israel should not invade Rafah and should provide, allow full aid in, and so on and so forth. The U.S. Delayed an Algerian-drafted resolution to implement those orders. That's what should happen under international law. The court issues the order, and then the Security Council should implement those orders. Instead, the U.S. hijacked the process, made false claims that Israel had accepted a ceasefire proposal, and got the Security Council, including the Algerians, to vote for this phony resolution, saying that they were going to provide a ceasefire. The ceasefire never happened. It only happened for a brief period just as Biden was leaving office, and then they quietly resumed it. So the net effect was of this so-called ceasefire process was to drag out the carnage for the remainder of Biden's term, and then have a brief ceasefire to get Gaza totally off the front pages when Trump got in there, and then to quietly resume the slaughter and to even accelerate it and to even, block, accelerate how much food they're blocking from getting in. The term has been used, genocide within a genocide, and that there have been layers of the genocide as they've, put the screws on ever tighter. So, again, the solution to this is, whatever action civil society can take. But in terms of the international stage, uniting for peace, this mechanism whereby two-thirds of the General Assembly can act, this was done against apartheid South Africa in the 1980s. It's what really got the ball rolling on serious economic and arms embargo of apartheid South Africa. That needs to happen here. It was also used in 1956 in the Suez crisis when Britain, France, and Israel invaded Gaza as well as the Sinai, and they were forced back using this mechanism, uniting for peace, whereby a majority of the UN steps up and overcomes a veto of a belligerent member.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Sam Husseini. I want to bring in some of the hunger fasters, but I want to ask you to respond to this phrase the U.S. ambassador said today at the United Nations in New York, that this is a matter of a resolution that would undermine the security of Israel. You want to translate that language into reality, that will undermine the security? Does that mean that if there's a ceasefire and the war ends, that Netanyahu might go to jail?
That might be the reality of it. I don't think that's how they intended it to be perceived.
I'm sorry. I just got carried away there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, he is facing charges, and he is a freaking serial offender of many laws.
Right.
And that wouldn't be exaggeration, right?
Right. I mean, I think that there are a lot of things driving the genocidal policy by Israel in the United States, and one of them may well be Netanyahu. If this, you know, were to actually end, the Israeli society would actually start to take stock and would, you know, move on the corruption and other charges. Obviously, Netanyahu also, you know, faces prosecution at the International Criminal Court as well now. He's been indicted there. I mean, the whole refrain of U.S. policy is blame everything on Hamas, no matter what. Israel could, you know, be starving and bombing, totally helpless people, and it's blame Hamas. It's everything. Blame Hamas. Hamas is endangering Israel no matter what. It's just a complete mantra that overtakes everything else.
Now, we are talking about, I think I mentioned something like 300 people murdered since Monday. We're talking about a figure that
it's all Hamas's fault.
And it's 54. We need to say this. I you hear them say it out loud. We need to say this. Over 54,000 people have been killed, murdered. 2/3 women and children, and we may not have seen the worst yet. Is there a peace movement? Where is your hope? I know that's a tough question, but what are you looking at? Obviously, peace treaties is at the core of everything. Ceasefire is crucial.
Yeah, it is a tough question, because I think the U.S. establishment, which is largely backing this genocide, has succeeded in getting it, as I say, off the front pages and making, you know, Trump the story every day. So it's all about his antics and his latest outrage and so on. So it's hard to, you know, for a lot of people with so many things to focus on what's going on here. But I think that this will be recorded as incredibly prominent thing during our lifetimes. We have an ongoing genocide, and it's up to people to pressure their own government and other governments. I mean, a major step was taken when South Africa invoked the Genocide Convention against Israel. They didn't do that out of the blue. They did it because a lot of people said, please do this. So what needs to happen is that a whole bunch of other countries, from Ireland to Brazil to Malaysia, need to be called to live up to their rhetoric. You know, they're calling it a genocide, but they're not, acting commensurate with that, either in terms of their unilateral sanctions and other actions that they can take against Israel, or multilaterally. I mean, the EU, you know, has put I don't know how many sanctions against Russia, and they're all still doing trade with Israel. That just the tip of the iceberg. The Arab countries need to have a reckoning. They've spouted rhetoric, but they've done virtually or exceedingly little, I should say. You know, we don't want this to be a world of Pontius Pilate's where everyone, you know, just pretends to do something and wash their hands of the situation and nobody steps up to attempt to stop it. And I think that it's up to people of conscience to pressure countries into doing that. And I think one major role, one major part of that is this Uniting for Peace process at the UN.
Again, that's our contributor, Sam Husseini, who contributes from Washington, D.C., tries to get in sometimes to the State Department press conferences and ask questions that aren't being asked. For that, Sam has taken quite a beating. We hope that you're recovering slowly. We do appreciate your tenacity in trying to get information out on the situation, although you oftentimes are facing very violent situations, and I know it takes a lot of courage, Sam, to stand forward. I'm going to ask you to stand aside for just one moment, Sam, and let's bring in some of the... There's a national, international hunger strike going on, calling for an end to the killing fields and the genocide via now by starvation. Among those who are part of the fast are many former military folks. I want to invite Joy Meltzer. She's a member of the Veteran for Peace. She's formerly with the USAF Academy, 23 graduate, and a conscientious objector. Joy, welcome to Flashpoints. Why are you fasting?
Hey, at the end of the day, I'm really fasting because I am devastated by what's going on and I needed to get out and do something about it. And this fast is organized by one of probably my favorite organizations on the planet, Veterans for Peace. And so I thought it was, and you know, this is something I had considered while active duty, thinking about what could make a real point, what could make have an effect, if not on our own government, then on the people around us. And hunger strikes and fasts have been pretty common throughout this movement. I'm thinking of Larry Hebert's hunger strike as an active duty airman outside of in Washington, D.C. back in it was last year. It was shortly after Aaron Bushnell's self-immolation. So it's something I've been thinking about for a while, and so when this opportunity came up, I immediately responded and said, I don't know if this is going to do anything. I don't know if it's going to move anyone, but I want to be a part of it, simply because I feel I have no other choice.
Using your sort of military background and your knowledge of laws of war and peace, when you watch what's unfolding in Gaza, 400 people, majority women and children, murdered in the last since Monday, and the killing fields are open, and they shut down the food distribution today. They said they have to reorganize, but as a what does this look like to you with all your background?
Well, it's clear and blatant a violation of international law, first off. And I mean, goodness knows you don't need an expert in military law or in international law, of which I'm not an expert. I had some core classes in it. I am very interested in just war theory, so I've done some of my own digging into that, as well as also had a core ethics class at the academy. But you don't really need an expert to see the atrocities that are going on and understand that they are at the very least terrible violations of human rights, and of course, you know, at the very highest, which multiple organizations have called it such, but you know, at the very highest it is a genocide, which is one of, if not the worst violation of human rights a country can commit. And so this watching the genocide unfold in Gaza, and watching the international community, and particularly my own country, do absolutely nothing about it, it really shook my confidence in the current world order. I grew up post 9/11, and a lot of the information that I was fed about the U.S. and, you know, the United Nations in general was that, you know, the reason we don't have wars like we did in World War One and World War Two is because of the United Nations and U.S. peacekeeping, and I put that in quotes, peacekeeping tactics, and that we were, in some sense, the police of the world. And I truly believed that growing up. But now looking at what this world order has allowed to happen and doing some digging into history and realizing that this is not an aberration at all since the United Nations founding. It's just, it seems to me like this is all these resolutions, all these countries talking at or with or at each other at times. It's a nice little legal shield to say that, you know, we're trying to do something, but in reality, the world still goes through wars. Humans across the globe are still suffering immeasurable amounts, and it really makes me, it really disappoints me, because with my background of it even being taught what's right and what's just, and not seeing that upheld by our leaders, our national leaders and our international leaders. And so a lot of times, you know, I get the feeling that people think I did, you know, I changed my thinking drastically. I really did a real 180. But at the end of the day, I as a person didn't change much, but my understanding of the world changed drastically. And I'm still out here fighting for what I believe is justice, for what I believe is right. And that's something I've done since I joined the Academy. It's just, what has changed is that I don't believe our government capable of doing that anymore.
Yeah. And let's also bring into this discussion our old friend, Cynthia Papermaster, Code Pink. She's been, she is from Code Pink Bay Area, and she is also on her 14th day of a hunger strike. And Cynthia, welcome back to Flashpoints. Thank you for coming back. Thank you for doing what you're doing, taking a stand for peace.
Thank you, Dennis. Yeah, I'm on my 14th day. I had a little blip yesterday. The Cuban diplomats who were touring the Bay Area received a proclamation at the Richmond City Council meeting last night, and afterwards there was the dinner party. And I went to the dinner party, I ate a taco. So, and I made the announcement that I was going to end my fast. But I changed my mind again today. I'm still on the fast. Really starving.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hey, who's calling out in the background there?
I don't know who that is.
Anyway. Okay. And the reason that Code Pink has given so much energy to this resistance, to this movement in support of peace and against the genocide, what is the motivating force? Why would you give up food? It's hard to give up food for one day.
Oh, well, Code Pink has been working around the Palestine campaign for 20 years. Code Pink, as you can see by looking at Medea Benjamin's Instagram every day, and Olivia DiNucci, who's our Washington, D.C. Code Pink coordinator, they are in Congress every day calling for aid to get through the border. They are participating in a big way on the March to Gaza, which is happening this month. Thousands of people are signing up via Code Pink and other groups to actually be on the ground going to Cairo and then marching to Gaza. I think it's 22 miles through the desert to Rafah to pressure the Israelis to open the border to aid going in. And then I also want to say that we have at CodePink.org a Fast for Gaza registration where people can sign up, and if they can't fast, they can donate their money to UNRWA to get help to get help to the people in Gaza. I'm having trouble because I start crying every few minutes now. And part of it's when you're hungry, when you're starving. Sorry.
Go on. Yeah. Did you finish?
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, if you haven't fasted before, you may not know, but your emotions become very raw. And it's easy to be triggered and to feel a lot of grief at times. And so please forgive me. I'm really suffering, not because of the fast, but because of what I'm seeing, happening. I want to thank Sam Husseini right now. Sam, if you're still on the air with us, your reporting is so essential, and it's and you're taking risks that I, for one, really appreciate. You're an activist as well as a journalist, and I know you're not supposed to be an activist and a journalist. That's some ethical thing, but I don't believe in that. I believe in doing action, and I love
it. We believe in being journalists, and let me bring Sam back, because we're just we're running out of time. Sam, again, where is this going? What we asked you, what could happen? What are your worst fears at this point?
My worst fears is that the U.S. gets its way and with Israel, and people dissipate and lose heart. What needs to happen? And thank you for that. Is people trying to reach people around them and globally to compel action. I'm just looking at my Twitter feed, and you know, somebody like Lula, the president of Brazil, makes a statement that Israel can't keep, you know, hiding behind this anti-Semitism thing for every time it, you know, kills a couple hundred people every few days. And you know, it's all over the, you know, and he's getting, you know, millions and millions of views, but somebody like him can take the lead of taking concrete action at the General Assembly, and they haven't done that. It is not the case that the United States government is complicit in this genocide. The United States government is a critical partner of this genocide. It's other countries that are complicit by not doing certain things, and by continuing to trade with Israel, for example, by continuing armaments, like they do with apartheid South Africa, they could suspend Israel from the General Assembly. They could even put in a peacekeeping force. That's what was done with the General Assembly in Uniting for Peace in 1956. So there are a whole series of, why should it be up to a few ragtag activists to be doing this freedom flotilla? You know, why aren't countries, you know, like Brazil and like Turkey and like China, you know, going in there to try to get supplies through? So we need to pressure them as well as those around us.
You work for Institute for Public Accuracy sometimes, and I have been a journalist a long time. And one of the struggles we have is there's this, it's been implanted in the corporate mainstream that journalism is he said and she said and you decide, as if there is not a truth to a situation. But here we're staring down the barrel of a genocide that's being supported by the United States with continuing shipments of masses amounts of weaponry. It's part of a starvation situation. Everybody knows what's going on. The people that the West sent in to deliver the food, they closed down today. They've got to reevaluate the situation. What do we think is going on here? What does the world think? Are not the Palestinian people being mass murdered? Are we not witnessing, all of us together witnessing a genocide? I'm saying we're all going to remember that this was happening. Well, not only did we watch, but we watched our government ship masses amount of weapons. What do, is there? Do we have a problem with journalism, Sam?
Oh, I think we have a very deep systemic problem with journalism, and I would take a little issue with what you said. I mean, you know, the sort of galvanizing event in my life was the build-ups to the wars against Iraq, and there we saw the major media not do he said she, you know, one side says this, one side says this. They just totally got behind the U.S. government and all its propaganda around what Iraqi weapons of mass destruction and so on and so forth. And it's been part of a larger agenda in terms of the Middle East for Israel and the United States to dominate the region. And, you know, there's some breakage, I think, and some media figures are sort of trying to distance themselves because they realize the historic nature of this. And it's like they're just kind of washing their hands of it to say a little something, to do a little something decent, but nothing enough to stop it, which is what's desperately needed, to genuinely challenge the clear genocidal nature of U.S.-Israeli policy here.
All right, well, we're going to leave it there, thanking everyone for taking the time out to be with us. The hunger fasters, the folks who are fasting to call attention to this genocide, now supported by starvation and an obvious attempt to... No trucks flowing into... We hear a lot about trucks going over the line. They're in Gaza, but they're not getting anywhere. And the stuff in the trucks, a lot of it is useless or not what is really needed. So, again, we're all bearing witness to something that will be a complete genocide if the world doesn't act, if the truth doesn't come out. Yes, the truth about the situation needs to be a part of our life. And we thank the hunger fasters for their courage in trying to call attention to it as well. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. A final comment? All right. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We take a short break. We come back and turn our attention to Haiti with Kevin Pina. Last he left us, we were tracking Blackwater through Haiti. Stay with us. Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We welcome back to the show senior producer Kevin Pina. Kevin, among other things, is a wonderful teacher, but he's also an expert on Haiti. He has been reporting for Flashpoints through two coups in Haiti, supported by the United States government. Kevin was on the ground delivering the information, again, up close, firsthand, originally, so that we really set the tone on the show for cutting-edge frontline information about Haiti and U.S. subversion in that government, which now is back again, Kevin, and the Haitian people are once again facing the destabilization policies of the United States, and yet and still the Haitian people are beginning to fight back again, and that's making the powers that be nervous. Yes?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the for me, the $64 million question is why on earth they don't support the self-defense brigades in Haiti, these community-based organizations that are proving quite effective. And we're not talking about the Bloc Malais, which is another part of the movement that really is sort of about vigilantism. We're talking about people who are working with local police to protect their communities. You know, several neighborhoods just this last week were labeled by the Haitian press as returning to normal as a result of community-based organizations that the police worked with, gave them arms, gave them training. Gangs tried to move back into those neighborhoods. They held them at bay. Things have been returning to life as normal. But that's not where they want to put their money, apparently. Because let's face it, as long as the gangs exist, the gravy train keeps rolling. It's the old game, right? It's to stay in power as long as you can, because every government job is considered a franchise. And this government is no different than any that preceded it, whether it was Prime Minister Ariel Henry after Jovenel Moïse's assassination, or whether it was Gary Conin. If they were smart, that's where they would invest, but that's not what they're doing. Instead, we see now bringing in Eric D. Prince, has a contract with the Haitian government, has been there since March, and quite frankly, even they haven't been effective. And now they're even using more desperate techniques. In addition to exploding drones, what they call kamikaze drones, now they're even assassinating members of the gangs with high-powered rifles with silencers on them. People are saying, people are dropping like flies in those neighborhoods, gang members, and nobody can hear a shot fired. So it's telling that despite the hundreds of millions of dollars, billions literally, that has been spent in Haiti, let's say since the 2004 coup, that nothing has ever been normalized, because quite frankly, it doesn't seem that was ever the intention. And what we've seen is it is really about destabilizing that government, keeping the masses of the popular movement, those same people when they were organized, they elected Aristide twice, once in 1991, once another time in 2000. Both of those ended in horrible, bloody coup d'etats and repression, immense repression. Both of those ended in destroying Haiti's democratic institutions. And of course, the U.S. and the so-called core group and the international community have always promised to rebuild it, but it's never happened. And so you got to ask yourself, what is the end game? And I think that we're seeing that in this attempt to rewrite Haiti's constitution, the 1987 constitution that was drafted in the wake of the fall of Duvalier, post-Duvalier. And what we're seeing is one of the major pillars of that constitution is that foreigners, foreign entities, corporations cannot own land in Haiti. They cannot own the mineral rights under the land.
Yes.
The Constitution says specifically it's about them being at the benefit for the Haitian people, and that's exactly what they're trying to change with constitutional reform in Haiti today.
All right, let me just jump in here. We're just about to up against the clock. Tell us, you've got an interview. We're not going to hear the name of the person because of fear of retribution, but quickly, tell us what you got for us. You've done some work.
I've got, innumerable people that I'm in touch with regularly. The Capitalist is one of them, in a clandestine interview from a gang-controlled area where he and his family have to struggle to survive, just to get water, to get food. And, of course, now in the middle of what's a war zone, nobody wants to be collateral damage from either side. And the fighting is intensifying, as you'll hear the description in this interview that I did earlier today.
All right, let's listen.
And this is senior producer Kevin Pino of Flashpoints, and we're going to feature an interview directly from the heart of the capital of Port-au-Prince in Haiti, which we hear ultimately is majority control. Most of the territory is controlled by the so-called paramilitary gang death squads of an organization called Vivre Ensemble. Of course, we see that there is a lot of money that was poured into the Kenyan forces that are part of the so-called multinational support network that also includes Salvadoran soldiers and other soldiers from other Caribbean countries and Latin American countries. And then, of course, we have the Police Nationale d'Haïti. But it appears that they have not been able to take back many of the neighborhoods that they've lost. We've got over 1.5 million people displaced from the capital today. And so our next guest is going to talk to us about that and more. Welcome back to Flashpoints.
Yeah, good evening, Kevin. It's always a pleasure.
So let's talk about the situation in the capital. Bring us up to date.
As for the situation, particularly in Port-au-Prince, where I am, has changed, despite all the operations that are led by the police, the special mission that is led by the Kenyans, and also this task force that was put together, you know, using police officer, some private, let's say, private military company that are helping them, you know, to track some of the gang leaders. They are using those drones that have explosive charge that we could consider like kamikaze drones, you know. They carry different explosive and they drop it, you know, in the area where they are targeting, you know, gangs and their installations. So now, normally every night you hear those, let's say, all the operation. Yes, the kamikaze drones, you know, those drones that are carrying, you know, explosive charge that they drop, you know, they have the certain position and they see where they're going to be exploding, they're going to drop those explosive charge. So with this situation, it seems that many gangs members, we don't have confirmation about Izo from Village de Dieu, that they are saying that he might be, you know, he might be wounded badly, but we haven't confirmation.
Vitalom
is wounded. We know that he is in an hospital, an area that is controlled by Lamour-Saint-Jean.
Well, let me just explain real quickly to our listeners. So Vitalom is one gang leader in one area of the capital, the Kaze Bayer gang, correct? And then
we've got
Izo, who is the head of what's called the 5-second gang, Cinque Segund, which is a nickname they have because that's how long it takes them to kill you. 5 seconds.
Yeah. The area that is controlled is called Village de Dieu, which is nearby the port, you know. They operated directly in downtown of Port-au-Prince capital.
So you said a very important thing, which we didn't really address, which is you said that they're foreigners, private contractors. And, of course, it was released by the New York Times earlier this week that Eric Prince,
yes,
famous of Blackwater, has been on contract with the Haitian government since March. Now, March was when Fitch-Jean took over the rotating presidency from Leslie Voltaire. So
exactly.
Blackwater, this Haitians are calling them mercenaries, U.S. mercenaries, blancs missionnaires, you know, they've been in there since March. And the CPT,
yes,
which is the council that was created in Jamaica, right, over a year ago, with Blinken on the sidelines, former U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, the CPT is seen by many as a creature of U.S. policy because of that. The CPT, 7 rotating presidents, right? But several of them can't take their seat because of corruption. But my point is that the CPT, which is supposed to be governing Haiti right now, did not tell people that they had hired Eric D. Prince, which is a group of U.S. mercenaries, and that's why we see these kamikaze drones, that they have been the ones who've been training and operating them with the Haitian police. Let's talk a little bit about what we know about that, what you're hearing in the Haitian press, and then what is the response of Haitians to Eric Prince working now with the CPT?
Yeah, it's for most of the political organization, you know, and most people, most people analyzing the situation, it's like a confirmation, because since March they've been, when they started using these drones, so we had rumors that it was private military agency, you know, that was helping them out. So by this article that was by the New York Times article last week. So we have the confirmation. It's Eric Prince, you know, that they sign, that they have a contract that they sign, and they should be sending, you know, they didn't say exactly, but they should be sending weapons and also military. They were 115 total. We don't have much detail on the contract, but now we have the confirmation that it's that, you know, which company it might be, you know, because from the government side, nor the CPT, they haven't publicly confirmed that, you know. So the population, since, you know, the using of this of these drones that normally people were thought that would give, you know, a good result. From the information that most of the people have, they killed some gang members, and probably the gangs still have the control of the area. That so I was saying that with this operation that they're making with the drone, we have information that some gang members were killed.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Kevin Pina, the senior producer, and I'm interviewing someone from deep in the heart of Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince. We're discussing the situation with the gangs. Eric D. Prince of Blackwater Infamy is now on contract with the Haitian government, has been there since March. Well, let me ask you this. I've also been hearing reports in the Haitian press that there's now this phenomenon of gang members who are getting single bullet shots to the head, like assassins, with silencers. Nobody hears the guns go off. But we're hearing that there are people who are falling like flies among the gangs, and it appears to be these same mercenaries with silencers on their guns. Have you heard that?
Yes, we've heard it, and it seems that among the private let's say military company, which we think now is the Blackwaters, they have snipers that they are using, and there are some people that they identify as gang that they are eliminating, you know. It's we heard about it, but it's not official, you know. But it seems that on the gang side, they are losing some of their members, you know, this way, and they're in an area and they get shot in the head, and if they are with other members, they just pick them up and go back to their camp with the body. So we haven't got any visual, you know, image of this kind of operation, but we are hearing it in the news.
Now, what's been the reaction of the Haitian press? What's been the reaction? I know that you're in touch with a lot of people every day. What's been people's reaction to this revelation? Because obviously the CPT, the ruling government of Haiti, hid it from people since March. Now they're suddenly getting confirmation that Eric Prince of Blackwater Infamy is operating in Haiti on contract with the Haitian government. What's been the reaction?
So the reaction is like, I have to tell you that all the political parties from which the member of the CPT came, you know, and the population, so the CPT lose their trust, you know, even from their party base where they come from. So now they think with this information and the tie that they see with Eric Prince and the U.S. president, so they think that it's a maneuver from them, you know, to get somebody inside the, you know, because they also said that Eric Prince is probably one of the advisor of the president, or he have the ear of the president. So
President Trump.
Yeah, President Trump. So they think it's a way for them, you know, since they don't satisfy, they don't accomplish, you know, what they were mandated to do. So now they're trying to get the support of the U.S. president and showing to people, you know, that they are trying to solve the situation and they are being effective so they could have two more years to stay in power, which is from all the political, most of the political parties and the population that is suffering with this situation is unacceptable. Because we've suffered too much, and the situation have degenerated, and with all the corruptions that is going on, they think, you know, they've been focusing themselves of enriching themselves and not doing anything for the population. So the population and also all the political parties, they are expecting to have to another form of government. And I also have to mention that we don't have an opposition yet that is proposing any specific solutions, you know, but the population is just tired of these guys because they did, you know, what they did, what they got, most of them got involved, you know, the way that they are paying themselves. So it's like their priority is to enrich them and stay in power, but not trying to solve, you know, the situation where we are currently. And this move is just, you know, to show, to have the support of the U.S. president and to show that they are doing their best to solve it.
Business as usual, it sounds to me. But, you know, it's interesting. You said there's no formal political opposition. It sounds like the people now, the mass of the people who've been affected, displaced, who've been killed by the gangs and continue to be their homes burned down and forced to sleep in the dirt, they're now the real opposition on the ground. Well, let's talk. Speaking of that, there's also a lot of opposition, popular opposition, against what they're calling reformation constitutionnelle, the constitutional reform, right? Where they're now, not only are they going to hold, promising they're going to hold elections for a new president and a new parliament, but they're also saying that they're going to hold a referendum on a new constitution. And there's a lot of concern around changing Haiti's 1987 constitution, and particularly those articles, Article 36, which forbids foreign ownership of Haiti's mineral wealth. It's supposed to be at the behest of the Haitian people to serve them. Talk a little bit about that.
So they also present, because they have a group that was working on that project, so they present the project. I haven't read the entire text, so, but from I'm learning from, you know, people analyzing and from people reaction to that. So I can say that they think that it's another way, you know, to make sure that foreigners will be able to own lands in Haiti. And it's I will search and give you this information later, because as I told you, I haven't read it, but most of the people that are reacting to that, they are just pointing out this one among others article that they are proposing that they don't agree with. But one of them is like that people are paying attention is the one that gives foreigners, you know, the rights, you know, to own lands, because we already have in the last constitution that we have, you know, foreigners can, you know, you can own a house, you know, a building, you know, in order to, you know, for business, even, you know, for private, but they cannot own, you know, lands and what's underneath. But with this article, you know, that they propose in their project, so foreigners will be able to own lands and what's underneath. So that was one of the points in most of the talk show that we are having. So they say that maybe, you know, particularly maybe the United States, but they say international community. So they are holding, they are showing the international community that they are in the agenda, you know, of providing them the rights, you know, in order to you know, to own fields. And you know that all the information that we have, that probably, you know, the golds and other precious metal that we have, so the
iridium,
you know,
iridium.
Foreign, yes, exactly, foreign company would be able to buy. And even the, you know, this is rumors, you know, that some of foreign people, particularly from the U.S., had already bought land in Haiti, you know, but in the format, you know, because using they were backed up by the change that they made in the last constitution. But normally these lands, they don't they can use it for, you know, to build houses, you know, for their business, to build, you know, industries, you know, but they are not, it's not giving them the right for what's under, you know, let's say
mineral rights.
Underneath
the mineral
so
rights. Yeah,
this one is, so it's for those that already bought land, and in area they suspected that we might have oil or other special let's say minerals. So they think that it's all, it's, they are following an agenda, and they are sending a signal, you know, to the international community that they will give them, you know, the opportunity, you know, to send companies in order to own lands and be able to, you know, to get whatever oil and whatever what they want to take from on the underground.
Right, because previously they would have to cut a deal with the Haitian government where they would have the rights to exploit. Like, there are mines in Haiti now that are run by Canadian companies and Russian companies either in Haiti. And they have a long-term sweetheart lease that they'd signed under the corrupt PHTK regime of Michel Martelly that's still continuing to this day. There were like 20-year leases. But they didn't have the right to the land. So there was a limit to their exploitation. And they would have to pay a percentage to the Haitian government, which ostensibly was supposed to go to the benefit of the Haitian people. Of course, under Martelly, it did not. they pocketed in their pocket like they stole so much else. It was really the second kleptocracy, you know, since Duvalier. And so now the struggle is, if they're allowed to own the land and the minerals underneath, then they will have unlimited ability to exploit them, and there will be no benefit to the Haitian people at all, as the 1987 Constitution says that should benefit the Haitian people, right?
Yeah, you're perfectly right. That's and it's that, it's this agenda, you know, that they are going through with, you know, to assure that they will stay in power for two more years to organize the election.
Unbelievable. We're going to have to leave it there. Again, thanks so much for joining us. Again, this is a clandestine interview from Port-au-Prince, deep in the heart of gang-held territory. Thanks again for joining us again, and we'll get back to you soon.
Okay, you're welcome. It's always a pleasure.
You're listening to KBOO.